Okay, so
thank you for coming. It's really nice to see you all again. I'm going to flick between screens because I can do that on my iPad. But I get to see you all. So this week is week 8. It's the video was, Michael's video was about stress and resilience. And I was thinking back to quite a few times in my life when, as Michael put it, what did he say in the question? He said, you had think about something that you never thought you would recover from, but at some point you found yourself as good as new. Well, that's kind of the story in my life, really. So I was thinking about what I was going to say, and there was a topic that came up at the conference that I talked about. So I'm really, really sorry, Jackie, if you're going to have to hear some of this again. But it was kind of the defining point in my life, I guess, as far as the principles understanding is concerned. So there was a point probably about 4 years ago where I had what I considered to be the perfect life. You know, I had a wife, I had a family, I had a business, I was self-employed, I was a musician, I was looking after my dad in his old age, and everything appeared to be as I always thought a life should be. I'd had a certain amount of status, and I had a nice car, and I had a nice house. What I didn't realize was that I spent so much time and energy trying to control things, trying to control my life so that I could maintain, this construct of a life that I had, so that I could maintain a happy family, and I could maintain a successful business, and I could maintain a working band and all the relationships that went with it. And sometimes it got really, really hard to do. It felt like I was trying to please everybody at once. So I would run from one thing to another, and I would never think that I was doing the best I could. But it was just constantly in my mind that I had to control these things. Otherwise, everything would fall apart. It felt like I had my arms around like a basket of snakes, trying to keep them all in. And they'd like pop out here and there. I had to catch one, and then I had to catch another one. Just so that I could feel better. So I could feel worthy. And I think going back, that was a big part of it, because I always felt that I really wasn't good enough. So all this good stuff that had come to me, I always felt I didn't deserve. So I had to work extra hard to keep it all in place, and to keep me feeling good, and to keep the people around me feeling good. So in very early 2013, when my wife said she didn't want to be married anymore, that set off a chain reaction of events that was something I didn't think I would ever recover from. So as my wife left, then I was looking after my son. I was still looking after my dad. Because I was looking after my son and my dad, I couldn't work full time in my design business. I had to work less and get paid less. There was a danger that the business would probably fold several times during that period. There was the thing about my family as well was that my family was my wife's family, really. I have a very small, I only had my dad and my sister, but I was really, really close to my ex-wife's family. And when we split up, the family came to me and said, "We're really, really sorry, but we don't really want to see you because it will upset our daughter." And we'd been married 20 years, so it was a really, really painful thing for me. So I had a situation where I had created this construct of a life that I thought that I was really defined by. I thought that it was me, it meant so much about me to keep everything in line, to keep everything in control. And over the space of a few months, what happened was pretty much everything fell apart. Everything fell away. Not one by one, but pretty much all at the same time. So there was a sense that all of a sudden, everything that I knew, everything that I'd worked for, and everything that I recognized in life had disappeared. And what was left in its place was this huge dark hole, this feeling of, I don't really know what's going to happen, but I think the only thing that can happen is it's going to be really, really bad. And as somebody who suffered from depression on and off over my lifetime, I think there was a thought that came to me that if I was to go down the path of anxiety and depression, clinical depression, which was where I was at one point, I didn't know where that was going to end up. I'd had suicidal thoughts before. And not acted them. I acted on them, thankfully. But there was something about looking over this big black hole and not knowing what was going to happen, and having everything that felt comfortable to me, everything that, even though I worked really hard to control it, it was my life. It was everything that I knew just kind of disappeared. So I was really scared that I would go down the route of suicidal thoughts, and I really didn't want to know where that was going to take me. And over a period of time, I was Sam was at home and I was looking after my dad, and then a little bit later on, Sam left for university and my dad died. So I didn't even have them to look after. That kind of kept me together for a little while. The the purpose of looking after them. So this sounds like a really bad story, doesn't it? I'm sorry, but it was a point where I felt that I had nothing left at all. And it was such good timing, thank you, universe, that I, around about the time that Sam was still at home, I came to the principles and I began to get an understanding of where that feeling of lostness was. I got really, really intimate with the lonely thought, and I began to see it. I began to see the thinking behind my complete terror about how my life was gonna play out. I began to see how everything that I'd done in my life, all the different roles that I performed, you know, father, husband, son, businessman, musician, I began to see how my attachment to those, how I define myself as those, had led to me wanting to control it, but feeling that somehow they were, that if I failed at any of them, that meant something about me. And as I, one of the biggest things that happened to me, as I came to the principles, I really, really, really began to see that even though I performed those roles and I loved the people that I was with, and I loved the people that I cared for, that wasn't who I am. That wasn't just who I was. I was something way bigger. We're all something way bigger. When I caught a tiny glimpse of that, I could see just how much of a construction I'd made of my life. It was like a building I'd made, really, really strong and really high. And I'd spent so much time trying to keep it in place and make it bigger because it meant so much about me. I saw that the amount of pain and effort and control and maintenance it needed had taken such a toll on me. And the reason I did that was that I was so scared that it would not be there. I was so scared that it would fall away. And then it fell away. Excuse me. Sorry. No. They want to clean my room. So I began to see. I began to see our place in things. I began to see my place in things. I began to see just how much of a creation that life was and how much I was so scared of it falling away. Now, it had fallen away. And when I began to see that, when I began to see my part in the creation as opposed to the part that I'd made up, that sense of peace returned to me. Not all at once, but I began to stop worrying about my feelings. I started to stop being scared of where those feelings were going to take me. And I began to sleep at night because I wasn't as scared as I wasn't as scared of those feelings. And I began to see that in each and every moment, all the feelings I was feeling, like the loneliness and the hurt, you know, my family saying that they would rather not see you because it'll upset people. You know, that had a real pain to it when I first heard it, but that began to soften. Because I began to see where they were coming from. They didn't know what they were saying was so hurtful, and they didn't really understand. They were just acting on their thinking. They were doing what was best for their daughter. So every single situation that I mulled over, everything that I'd lost, I kind of found a different thought for. A new thought came along. And something very magical began to happen, that when I began to have these new thoughts and new feelings, a sense of peace really came to me. Not all the time. I kind of went back to it every now and again. But overall, over a period of a few months, this sense of being looked after, this sense of the kindness of the design, as Michael calls it, I really began to see that, because in places where I'd lost something, so in places like my design business, what happened was I began to see other opportunities. I began to see that there was a new life. And that was around the time that I began Supercoach Academy, and I got to know this community, and I got a lot deeper into the principles. But there was a weekend at Supercoach Academy where I stood up. It was like somebody at an Alcoholics Anonymous thing. And I stood up and I put my hand up and I said, I don't see a dark hole anymore. All I see is a field of possibilities. There's something in front of me that is so perfect and magical and unfolding for me that I could not see when I was so caught up with how my life should be, how I thought my life should be, how I thought I had constructed it to be. And I can't tell you, you know, the adventure that I've had over the last year or so has been without any control whatsoever, without any obvious planning. It's mostly been just letting go of what was before, without any of this angst about where I should be as opposed to where I am. My life has just unfolded really, really, really gracefully. And as Michael says, it's not about being in this state of perfect consciousness all the time. It's not like everything goes perfectly all the time. It's being grateful for the highs and graceful for the lows, because there are still lows, but they just don't feel so significant now. Doesn't hurt as much. I can't tell you how beautiful this feels. To be able to be able to sit in the unknown, to rest in the unknown, and be completely trusting that life, the universe, has got my back. Because that's not where it was. I thought the unknown was a place where I was going to end up killing myself. This is where we all are. This is what is available to all of us. It's this place is just sitting underneath that storm that we've got going on up here. Thank you for listening to that. Bless you, bless you. So, Sparkles, is Mo with us yet? Can't hear you.
Can you see me, Steph?
No, I can't see you.
Oh, Maureen is on. Yes, we have Maureen.
Okay.
Maureen is in the room.
Hey!
I apologize. I was having internet problems in the beginning. So I heard part on my cell phone as I rebooted the computer.
Okay.
I went inside and thought about it and restarted the computer and you all appeared.
That's wisdom. That's techie wisdom.
What the whole program is about.
Yeah.
Living from the inside out.
Yeah.
That was pretty powerful, Steph, what you just shared. And when I first heard Michael's, the thing on Sunday, I reflected back a lot on my past and think at moments too where I thought I would never be happy again, never be able to find joy. You know, when you go through the death of the baby and divorce and death of the first of when he died and just certain things in my life, I thought, oh my God, I'll never be happy again. But then there was something in me that always said, that's not me. I'm to be happy. I'm to be joyful. Because that's what I love to do. That's when I love myself the most. So when I'm at that state. This is all for 3 P's. But so it really, when I learned the principles, everything, you know, kind of all made sense about how we have those lows and then we're always able to come back to our original state, who we really are, that original place of love and joy, which is what we're meant to be. And I wanted to share with y'all what happened last week. Last Tuesday on the call, I don't know if y'all recall, I told you I'd gotten a call from I had a guy's house listed, a man's house listed, and his son had moved to New Jersey, and he wanted his father to move with him, but the father really didn't want to go. So every time we tried to show the house, he'd say no. So it was kind of a joke that we have it listed, but you really can't show it because he doesn't want you to come in, right? But so I had gone to check on him because his son, you know, was worried about him and had found him, and he wasn't doing well. And last week, you know, we were talking about being, God, last week sounds like a year. It feels like a year ago. We were talking about, what was it, Steph, being the victim, being empowered, and being enlightened. And so when I found him, as he was the victim as I take it, because he was disabled. He wasn't able to move. He's on oxygen. I started doing all these things I thought I had to do to care for him, which is the empowered part in us coming in. We have to be the hero. Let's fix him, right? And then when I said, you know, what is it that you need? What else can I do for you, Rolf? And he said, just smile. And that brought me back to, it's not really our doing, it's our being is what matters. And so last week on the call, when we got off the call, which was a beautiful call, we were all in that, I was in a very beautiful place. And when I looked at my cell phone at the end of the call, I had 5 missed calls from him, which I can't ever recall him really ever calling me. So I called the guy, and I called Rolf, and he says, I'm fallen, and he couldn't get up. So I said, do you want me to call an ambulance? He said, no, just come help me. So I went over there. Well, he's like 6'2". He's very thin now, but I still was having trouble. Really couldn't pick him up. So I just laid with him on the floor and gave him some Gatorade, something to drink, to try to bring back some of his strength. Because he said he'd been laying there for a couple of days. I really don't think he was. I think he might have been there for maybe a day. So I gave him some Gatorade, get his strength up, and we sat there and we talked. And so I apologized for not answering the phone the first time. I told him, you know, we were on this call. So he asked me what it was about, and I told him. And he was so, I really thought, oh, we don't have anything else to do, right? He's laying on the floor. He's like, let's just let it all out. So I start talking about the principles and what I've seen, what I knew. And even told him about what happened at the prison, because like I said, I was just trying to comfort him. And he really took it in. And he finally looked at me and he said, so I'm forgiven. God forgives me. And I said, well, yes. He, from what I see and what I felt, God loves all of us. It doesn't matter what we do. I said, just like your son, I said, no matter what he does, you still love him. He's your son. And he said, yes. And I could see him lighten up. So I finally get him up into a chair. And that's Tuesday. So I'm in and out on Tuesday checking on him once I get him back to his chair. His son, I call his son in New Jersey. His son's pretty angry. My son's angry with the father and just saying things. And I said, all that matters is now. I don't care about anything in the past. And I really don't care about tomorrow. We just need to deal with what's presented to us right now. And so for the next couple of days, I'm going in there every couple of hours checking on him. Well, it ends up by Thursday, he has not moved out of that chair. So he's been sitting there. Using the bathroom on himself. Wouldn't allow me to bring anybody in. Would not allow any kind of assistance. The police, everybody said, there's nothing you can do. If he says no, we're not allowed to go in. We're not allowed to touch you. So all I could do is just go in and sit and be with him and talk to him. Sometimes we'd talk, sometimes we wouldn't. And the conditions were unbelievable. I mean, the smell was horrible. But once I entered the room with him and would sit with him, I really kind of didn't notice the smell for a while. But then eventually I would have to get up and go outside. But so on Thursday, I get there and Thursday's the day he was in so much pain. I could see he was uncomfortable the other days, but now he's in excruciating pain. And I just looked at him and I just said, are you ready to die? And the minute I said those words, I was like, oh my God, where did those words come from? Why did I say that to him, you know? But, and he just said, yes. So I tried to make him comfortable. And I finally said, after sitting with him a little while, about hospice. And do y'all have hospice in other countries? I don't know if anybody knows. Hospice is where people go to die. They don't save you. They just make you comfortable so you can pass over. And so I talked about hospice. I said, why don't we call hospice? Your son will be here Saturday. His son couldn't get there till Saturday, son and daughter. And I said, why don't we call hospice? And they won't save you. They're not going to do anything to sit, you know, to make you live any longer. They'll just make you comfortable so you won't be in pain and clean you. So when your son gets here on Sunday, on Saturday, you know, he can see you. You'll be able to see him. So he finally mumbled the words, yes. And at this point, it was where he couldn't speak hardly anything. So real quick, I call hospice. I get him on speakerphone because now I've been calling hospice for 3 days. And they're like, we can't do anything without his permission. So he says yes to them because she asked him some questions and he finally mumbled the word yes. So she's like, well, on Friday at 2 o'clock, we'll send somebody out to assess him. And I'm like, oh my God, Friday, this is Thursday. I don't know how much longer I can hang on. So he asked me for his medicine. And I go to the kitchen. He tells me it's on a shelf by the stove. I'm going through every cabinet, drawer. There is no medicine. All I find is one inhaler. I bring it to him. And he's nodding his head, no, that's not it. So I go back and I just say, Rolf, there is no medicine. I've been in every cabinet, every drawer, bathrooms. There's no medicine. So he just went, okay. So I sit with him. I leave Thursday night. And every day I'd go in, I was hoping I would find him dead. And that's a terrible thing. But no one should live in the conditions that he was living in. I felt like no one deserved to even die the way he was dying. I mean, I'd be strong when I was in the room with him, but when I'd go sit in my car for 30 or 40 minutes and then come back in, I would like lose it in my car. But then I'd walk back in and it'd be like you're a different person. But so finally on Friday, the hospice nurse showed up at 2. And when he showed up at 2, he looked like an angel. I was starting to lose it. When he walked up, I just said, please don't leave me. You have got to help him. No one deserves to die this way. So the hospice nurse walks in. And by this time now, he's kind of gone into a coma. The nurse really couldn't get him awake. And so they did call for an ambulance. Now it's 2 p.m, but the ambulance won't come till 8 o'clock tonight. And I'm thinking, oh my God, oh my God, 6 more hours, you know? Can he hang on 6 more hours? Can I hang on 6 more hours of this terrible smell? And by the time he leaves and before the ambulance comes, he kind of comes conscious again. He doesn't remember the hospice nurse coming in. So I'd have to tell him again where he was going and why. And he would finally say, okay. Because my fear was if the ambulance got there, if he said no, they would not take him. So I had a little bit of that fear. I've got to keep him calm. Relax, so he will go with them. So it ends up, he drifts in and out, and every time he wakes up, I remind him, they're coming, you know. But, and he kept calling out for his son. So finally, I get his son on the phone again, and he talks to him on the phone. This is now about 7:45, about 30 minutes before the ambulance gets there. So he's able to have a conversation with his son. He falls back asleep. The ambulance comes. He wakes up, and thank God, he agreed to go with them. And so I follow him to hospice. We get him in there. They get him all cleaned up. They get him in his bed. And he says, he's blowing kisses at the nurses. He's doing this. He's winking at them. And so I come in the room. And he's so clean now. Oh, my God, he's so clean. Because he was just full of feces. But it didn't matter. Even when I was in that space with him, it didn't matter. I still kissed his head, held his hands, even though there was just stuff all over him. When you're in that, it doesn't matter. But seeing him in that bed, he was so happy. He looked at me. He blew me a kiss. He winked. And he did this. And at that moment, I knew everything was going to be okay. So the next day, I go home feeling, I was on such a high, and it's like midnight when I'm leaving hospice. But I was so keyed up because I knew now everything was going to be okay. And the son came on Saturday. The son and daughter came down from up north, saw him on Saturday. He died Sunday morning. And so when I went to the house with the son and the daughter, I said how he had asked for the medicine, and they were real upset over the condition of the house and what he'd been going through. And he said, I told him how he had asked for his medicine, but all I could find was an inhaler, that there was no medicine. And the son goes, no, his medicine's right here. He opened the kitchen cabinet, and there were three shelves. This far left cabinet were three shelves of medication. And I thought, that wasn't there. I went in and out of that kitchen three or four times. I could tell you where the Ritz were, the soup, the Gatorade. I knew where everything in that kitchen was. For some reason, that left cabinet door was never opened by me. Now, I had some thinking on it, like, well, had I opened it and given him the medicine, would he have OD'd there at the house? And he would have never have been able to die with the dignity that everyone deserved. I mean, that he deserved. I mean, or his son would have came in and found him in that home, laying in feces everywhere. So for me, there was something bigger in play through the whole thing. The son, you know, was beating himself up. Should I have come sooner? When I first told him about it, instead of being angry. But I could see where the whole thing really played out, I thought, universally, because he was able to be removed from that environment on his own free will. And his son and daughter were able to have that last day with him in that caring, peaceful, clean environment and not there in that home. And there was no judgment on him. There was no judgment on the son. It was just, there was no blame. It just was. And really, it just really just goes to, I told the nurse when he asked me something, I said, all he needs is love. That's all any of us need is love. And that's why I'm just asking you to please help me getting to that facility where he can love himself again too. so he doesn't have to go like this. And the son said something to me about, you know, caring for his father. And I can remember just saying to him, I feel like it was an honor and a privilege to be able to have been with him, even in those conditions, until the end. And it was, you know, I thought back, I thought, in 3 weeks, we battled a hurricane. We had the birth, I was in the room with my daughter, I was with her at the birth of a granddaughter. And the day she came from home from the hospital is the day I walked in and found him for the first time. So it was kind of like ironic. In the last 3 weeks, we went from hurricane to the birth of new life, to the life of someone else who I didn't even know his birthday. I didn't know his age. I didn't know if he had any, I knew nothing except he used to come in our restaurant and sit at the bar and he would like a cup of coffee and a brandy. And that's all I knew. And it didn't matter. He was just, it is just us as person to person, just loving people no matter what and under any condition. And it kind of just really made everything else in life look small.
Wow.
But
that's beautiful, Molly. Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. And does anybody have any hands up or anything they want to share?
Okay. At the moment, I don't see any hands up, but please, if you'd like to ask a question or say a comment, maybe. Please raise your hands and I will unmute you.
I think we're all having a moment.
We're all having a moment.
So I would like to ask anybody Michael's question. About, was there ever a time that you never thought you'd recover? And then at some point you did.
Ah, we have a hand. Simon, I've unmuted you.
Thank you.
Hey, Simon.
Hello.
Hey, Simon.
When Steph had finished, then I thought, you're going to be, it's a tough gig to follow that one, Maureen. But, you know, that was just great. Both of you, fantastic. It's lovely. So my story is not quite, doesn't quite meet Michael's question, but it's pretty close to it, I think. So I think we all have that, we all have that kind of good enough thought, am I good enough? I think that all pops into our heads. And the gender stereotypes are, you know, show themselves in different ways on that. So for me, it's and being a small business owner and and always been that way. Apart from when I was working for my dad, you know, I could relate to Steph's stuff. So I got out of a business after many years, and I'd always been worried about failure, and I'd had that good enough question a lot of the time. You know, I took it over from my dad, and I remember one beach holiday when I was a kid, you know, and he said something like, "Will I have a business to go home to when I, you know, when I come back from holiday?" So, you know, I'm talking 1970s here. You know, he never rang in to see how business was doing, but he had that worry about failure, and I somehow picked up on that, and then the whole thing of being self-worth is intricately connected to our business success. So I felt for you on that stuff. Anyway, so my old business, it just got too hard, and I got out of it. And then I tried for the next 18 months. I'd learned some consciousness stuff along the way, and that had really helped me actually get out of the business without feeling that getting out of the business was a failure. So yeah. I got out with a few years' salary, not retirement money, but I then channeled for the next 18 months. I channeled that into a load of the money and all my time and effort into doing a consciousness program for small business owners. And I was on a real mission, you know. Mm-hmm. I was empowered, I guess, rather than enlightened. I thought I could, like, yeah, everybody should know what I do. And then we started marketing, and it just wasn't going anywhere, you know. Couldn't get any traction whatsoever. I just thought one day, this isn't going to work, you know. I'd always been afraid of failure, and it wasn't a commercial success. It was a commercial failure, but that commercial failure did not lead to my death. I am still here, as you can see from the picture. But I thought it was going to do, you know. Mm. I thought business failure was going to lead to death.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things, but if you'd said that to me any time in that 18 months, because I'd never had a towards before really in business. I'd always been let's avoid failure, right? Let's avoid failure. People came on to me, oh, you've got to have goals. So I'd set goals set financial goals, and sometimes I hit them, and well, once I hit it, and that didn't make me happy. I'm like, shit, you know. Mm. But I was always shit scared of failure, and so it failed that venture, and but I, you know, I survived, and that was the biggest thing that came out of it, you know. It still comes back, you know, it still comes back at times. The fear of failure. Cause so I had a few other things that happened worked out since I'm still alive and I'm still unfolding. And I guess, the big thing you talked about control and stuff, and that abdication of control and trust in trust in the universe to deliver is kind of where I'm at the moment, you know.
Yeah. So do you, I mean, I have a, before I came to this understanding, I thought that every kind of traumatic period in my life was I got lost in and I couldn't see any value in, and somehow, some way, I managed to just about survive it and go on to the next thing. And I look back on my life now at this, you know, series of events that happened, and in most cases, something I learned something really cool, and something so much better kind of showed up afterwards. Even if that fell away into the formless, something fell up, and that kind of gives me such a comfort and a trust in this kindness of the design now, because I can look back at my life and think, wow, I screwed up so many times. I screwed up in the most enormous ways, but it still worked out all right. And as you say, I'm still here. I'm still here, and I'm having, this is the best part of my life ever, you know. Thank you, Simon. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else? Anybody else got any reflections or anything they've noticed from what we've been talking about on this call? Anything that's hit home or anything that kind of really doesn't make sense? We've only got a couple of minutes to go because I talked way too long.
I did too.
No hands.
I like the silence as well. Okay, Thomas.
Thomas, let me find you, Thomas, and I'll unmute you. There you go, Thomas. Can you?
Hello.
Good.
Hello.
We can hear you.
Thank you, everyone. It's a privilege to be here. Really. Maureen, your story, what happened to him and you, and something similar happened to me this spring when we were supposed to be having a nice weekend, me and my new girlfriend, or what you call it, and it was like in Sweden, and it was like the first lovely days in the spring, and I knew her father were home just by himself, and we had like a program for him, or we initiated a program where he were supposed to be training from, and like make it easier for his lungs to be able to breathe. But then he was disconnected like for a couple of days, and that was not unusual because he went in by himself and like really disconnected sometimes. But I just went into the city and I told her, let's bring him out in your house for the weekend and just for the fun of it. But do you really want that? But no, he's with his friends, and let's wait and see what happens. And so I said, no, but really, I should check up on him. So I went by, and he was naked in the hall. I couldn't get inside, but I saw him, like, I looked where he dropped the mail, and he was like, he'd been laying there for like 3 days. Since she like hung up on him, he slipped in the bathroom and fell out in the hall. And he was like 33 degrees body temperature, and the ambulance came and everything. It was really critical for like 2-3 days, and we weren't able to communicate with him or anything, but he recovered. And then we had like 2 weeks in the hospital with him. It was like meant to be. It was, I forgot it, how you can forget, but you brought it to life, and it makes completely different sense in hundreds of ways. So it's, thank you really for sharing.
Thank you, Thomas, for sharing.
Thank you, Thomas.
Made him come alive again. Wow.
Oh,
and that's walking around making me dizzy.
Sorry,
going through that tunnel that I
yeah. I'm sorry.
No matter what, life just keeps coming at us. We just have to keep our balance and know we're going to fall, but it's okay. We'll get right back up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Thomas.
So thank you, everybody. I think we've gone over again. It's just been so beautiful. I love getting the chance to explore with you guys. Maureen and I are so grateful for this opportunity to be with you every week. I don't know what's going to happen when it finishes.
Thank you. I'm going to unmute everybody everyone can wait and say goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.